Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Flory, Judge Reyes, Judge Smith, the Honorable James B. Flory presiding.
Welcome to the Court of Appeals. Please be seated. So it's September 18th, and we have had six matters on our calendar today. The first matter, 9:30, we have continued at the request of the parties due to one of the attorneys being trapped in, I think she got as far as Chattanooga, Tennessee, before she realized she wasn't going to make it here. So anyway, so that matter got continued. And so we're ready to proceed with the 10:05 matter. I understand counsel is ready to proceed on that matter, even though we're a little early. So I'm sure you're probably familiar with our proceedings here. You'll each have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, and counsel for appellant will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal if you wish. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed. And please start your arguments by identifying yourselves for us for the record, please.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jennifer Tone. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Christopher Malls. Mr. Malls was committed as a sexually dangerous person, sexual psychopathic personality, SDP, SPP, by the trial court, and this appeal follows. I want to start out by kind of addressing what I think might be somewhat unusual in these cases. In my brief, I am advocating for a change in the law, and I recognize that this is not kind of the typical court of appeals type argument, and that this court may not necessarily have an ability to make the changes that I'm suggesting must be made. However, it's an argument that I felt needed to be made, and that's why I am making it. From our position, the law is behind the science. And when we look at the case law factors that this legal test, we have a legal test that has been developed by case law for cases that were released in the 1990s. And in this particular case, we had undisputed trial testimony that the research has significantly advanced since the time those case law decisions were released. Back when those decisions came out, we did not have the research available that we have today on sex offense-specific recidivism or the risk assessment tools for evaluators to use in courts to consider when making these decisions. So it made sense that we needed some kind of guidance at the trial court level to make these difficult and complex determinations. However, as the testimony in this case supports, today, we have a vast majority of research and risk assessment tools that are commonly accepted, widely used for the purposes of indeterminate civil commitment available to the courts, available to help inform the court's decision. And this simply means that these case law factor tests are outdated and no longer helpful.
How are they outdated?
When the decisions were released in the 1990s, they were based on research that predated that, the 1950s, 60s, and 70s.
But I understand that. I understand your argument of, well, actually, I don't understand your argument for the change of law.
Okay.
And here's why, is because the case law that's out there talks about evaluating a number of different factors. And the Supreme Court has said, you're not limited to any one set of factors, but here are some of the ones that you can consider, look at the totality of the circumstances. Why is that not a good approach?
And I think this case actually illustrates that. So in this case, the undisputed trial testimony is that the risk assessment tools are the most reliable predictors of risk. They're the best available evidence that
but
we have.
But which ones are you talking about specifically, though?
For
are you talking about the
tools?
Static 99R and Static 2002R? Or are you talking about the SAPRO, which tests or tests are you specifically talking about are better?
I don't think you can separate. I mean, I think in general, what the research has shown is that the use of risk assessment tools.
Right, no, I understand that, but okay. When I read your brief and your arguments, it seems like you're relying on tests that have been around for quite some time, the static tests in particular.
Certainly.
Those have been around for quite some time, so why... I'm trying to understand why you say we should be looking at other tools, but when in reality you seem to be looking at at least two of the tools that have been used for some time and relied upon by the courts for some time.
Sure. And so if I can try this to answer your question, we can't rely on a single tool or two particular tools in a vacuum to determine risk. We have to look at, you know, the multifactored analysis that the courts have often talked about as being important. That's also important when you're using different tools. Different tools look at different things. So the static tools that you referenced, the 99R and the 2002R, are based on static, historical, unchanging factors. Those have been revised and updated over time. So while they have been around for a period of time, they also continue to be updated. But then when you're looking at tools like, in this particular case, the SRAFV, that looks at dynamic or changeable risk factors. Also very important when you're predicting risk. And then the SAPROV, the SAPROF, that looks at protective factors. That's more current research. And that says that it's also important to consider protective factors so that you really get this holistic picture of risk, considering static, dynamic, protective. So you have to look at all of those things in conjunction with each other in order to get this multifaceted assessment of risk. And those things continue to change and evolve. Those tools get revised and updated. And when you look at the case law factors, those things don't change. And risk assessment is very complex and nuanced. So something that may seem simple and plain logic to us, if we're not trained in risk assessment, the evaluation is much deeper, much more nuanced than what may appear on the surface.
Right, but the Supreme Court has also cautioned against just relying on tools.
Absolutely.
And your brief relies on, I think, primarily three tools, a two static, actuarial tests.
Correct.
And is it the SAPROV? Is the other one?
Yep, I think that's for protective factors.
Right. But that only provides a certain picture, and the Supreme Court said, take that broad look. When I read the district court's order, it seems like he did indeed take that broad look. He looked at the expert testimony. He weighed the expert testimony. He looked at these actuarial tests and their limitations and looked at not just one set of factors, let's say the Lenihan factors for SDP, but he looked at the factors from all the other cases that have been cited. So I'm having a hard time understanding where the district court got it wrong in this particular case. Okay.
So a point of clarification. When you consider the static tools and the dynamic tool and the protective factor, you are looking at the entire history. From a risk perspective, those things within a person's history that are pertinent to the prediction of risk. So when you're using the combination of those tools together, you are taking that holistic picture that you're talking about. And I think that when you... Let me step back here for a second. So in this particular case, the trial court relied on certain factors. The ones that jump out are, say, antisocial orientation, sexual deviance, supervision violations. The pertinent parts of those three factors that are relevant, truly relevant to risk, as supported by research, are incorporated and included within the tools. From my perspective, it's clear error to pick out three factors from the tools and say that somehow the presence of these three factors is more persuasive, more credible, more telling as to a person's dangerousness as compared to when you have these authors who create these tools based on research and specifically assign certain weights to each factor to come up with this predicted risk.
Right, but you still have three experts that provided data here.
Correct.
And two of those experts looked at the static tests.
Yes.
Okay. And those two so-called experts, let me rephrase that, that's not fair. These two experts, because they are experts, they're doctors, and they have expertise in this area. But experts that the courts rely on, the parties rely on, had two different interpretations of the same test. And I understand part of your argument is we should be moving away from subjective analyses to more objective tests that will provide information to the court. But even with these supposedly objective tests, you have two different results from them. So I think the district court kind of acknowledged that there's still, even with these tests, there's some subjectivity in them, and that's where the credibility determination comes in for the judge to look at how these experts interpreting these tests and what their testimony is and what their position is on them.
I think when you look at Dr. Marshall's opinion, the only tool that she scored was the static 99R, and that came back, she actually categorized it as below average risk, which it actually should have been in the average risk category. In any event, her testimony was that the tools provide the best available measure of risk. The static 99R in particular is widely accepted, commonly used. There's a lot of research supporting it. It's a good tool. And when we talked about the generations of risk assessment, we started with clinical judgment, right? So it's an evaluator saying, I think these things are predictive of risk. Are these things present or not present in this person's history? You can assign whatever weight you want to it as the evaluator and say, I think this person is high risk, moderate, low, whatever the characterization is. And that's that subjectivity side. And then you move to that more objective side where you're using the tools. Granted, there may still be some subjectivity in the scoring of those, but you have manuals. You have the research that says if this factor is present, you know, it's a formula. It's not an evaluator saying that I think this one factor should be given more weight than these other factors, and I'm somehow interpreting these results. The tool provides that objective data for you. And I think in the case of Dr. Marshall, what she did was score this one particular tool, find that it's low, below average risk, and say, you know, in my clinical judgment, that doesn't seem right. So I'm relying on all of these other things. And many of the things that she testified about that she relied on are actually incorporated within the tool. You know, sexual deviance was a big one for her. And when she was asked, what does that include? Do you have a stranger victim? Do you have a male victim? Do you have unrelated victims? Those are three factors within the static 99R. So many of the points that she made to justify her conclusion, which the district court relied upon, are actually incorporated in the tool. And I think that is where that clear error is with respect to her opinion and that particular tool and the district court's analysis of her opinion.
Should clinical judgment, in your view, then never be play a part?
No, I would not advocate that position. There are cases where the tools can't be used, such as juvenile-only offenders, female offenders. So you have to have some flexibility here for the court to listen to what the experts say. And this kind of goes back to why I think the law needs to be changed. There needs to be flexibility. Right now, we are locked into this case law and research that is outdated. We've got current research and best practices. And
how is it limited? I don't understand that flexibility argument, because it seems like there is flexibility there. The Supreme Court has outlined factors to consider in a number of different cases, tools that can be used, and has said to the district court, take a broad view of these issues when you're evaluating them. How is there not flexibility built into the current test?
Because my understanding of the way the case law is written is that the experts have to look at and review these case law factors, and the district court has to look at them. The district court obviously has discretion not to give them weight, but they're required to consider them. And I think this particular case kind of highlights the conundrum that you can find yourself in. And this is maybe not a great example, but I was trying to think of an analogy to come up with. And my comparison is a DWI case. So an officer sees a gentleman driving a vehicle, suspicion of DWI, pulls him over. Officer observes indicia of intoxication, stumbling, slurred speech, maybe the odor of alcohol emanating. The gentleman submits to blood, breath, urine test. The results come back, point zeros across the board. We go to trial. The judge hears the testimony of the officer. I think he was impaired. Here are all the reasons why I think he was impaired. The test results from the blood, breath, urine also come in. In that case, the district court convicts the gentleman of DWI based on the officer's observation. That's similar to what happened here. So it's undisputed. Both of the experts said the most reliable research we have, or the best available evidence of risk prediction, are the tools. And the case and the clinical judgment is less reliable than the tools. And when Dr. Marshall, in particular, in this case, said, I scored the tools, they all say he's below average risk. I don't need to score more of them, because they would all say that as well. I'm using my clinical judgment, and I'm using research that is older, which she, again, acknowledged has changed substantially, and there's a broad spectrum of research that has usurped that older research. And she still says, based on these things, these case law factors, he's high risk. And that to me is the clear error.
I mean, there are a couple, I don't know that, A, of course, and you, I think, questioned this, and what a court of appeals can do to change a law is obviously an issue, the Supreme Court's law. Secondly, so in this case, so I'm not sure what you want to change it to. That's what I'm trying to figure out. And I also have, you know, for opposing counsel, I'm not exactly sure, like, the case law identifies factors, recognizes there are tests, warns not to be duplicative of the factor that's built into a test. Not sure how a district court is meant to handle that. I mean, I do wonder about that and how that works. But here, is what you're saying, that here, because tests were given, clinical judgment could not be used because it was, because it's, I'm trying to figure out what the problem is precisely in terms of the legal test
in
here.
In this particular case, yes, because again, the undisputed expert testimony was that clinical judgment's the least reliable method.
So is it a change of law you're advocating, or just saying in this particular case, the balance, you know, the conclusions drawn from it were clearly erroneous, or the findings drawn based on what was presented?
I'm arguing both.
Okay.
I recognize the limitations asking the Court of Appeals to overturn Supreme Court case law. I get that. Again, I'm still making that argument. If I'm not successful in this case, perhaps I will petition the issue to the Supreme Court. But I'm also arguing that because the district court did that, that was a clear error, and that this case should be vacated. The commitment should be vacated. And to follow up with your question about what am I asking, I think that if we get rid of the required or permissive consideration of the case law factors, the new instruction to the trial court is that the trial court should consider the empirically valid risk factors and the methods for measuring those risk factors based on current research and best practices within the field.
So trial court judgment really doesn't play any, it sounds like you're advocating a mathematical formula, quite frankly. So where does judicial judgment come into play in interpreting that, then?
I'm certainly not advocating a mathematical formula. I don't think that, you know, the court has addressed, should this be a matter of statistics? Should we only rely on the risk assessment tools? And that's not what I'm suggesting should be done. I still think that the district court has to hear all of the evidence from the experts and get that, what does the current research say? What is the best available information that we have today say? And what's the best available method for predicting something that is inherently really, really difficult to predict? And so the district court is still in that judicial discretion position where they've got to listen to all that evidence, evaluate it, and then make a reasoned decision based on current research, not something from decades ago. And I see that my time is up, so.
Thank you.
Thank
you. 5 minutes for rebuttal, if you wish. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I am Assistant Attorney General John Gross on behalf of the respondent, Blue Earth County. Counsel is asking this court to overrule established Court of Appeals precedent without a compelling reason to do so. And I really appreciate counsel's candor and to the legal reality that you obviously cannot overrule established Minnesota Supreme Court precedent. What this really comes down to is the compelling reason. Now, counsel has pointed out to testimony in this particular case as how this is evidence to support her position that the case law factors should be outdated, ignored, and things like that. But this is an exact argument that counsel has raised and other attorneys have raised in a number of appeals over the past few years. In fact, one of the unpublished cases that I cite to my brief, Radke, this specific information, almost the exact same information, was provided by Dr. Kenning to the district court in that case, and then this court considered and rejected. The citation is contained in my brief, but it is 2014 Westlaw 4494262. At the italics 4 page, it starts, the paragraph starts, Dr. Kenning also reported on the application of the Linehan factors. The following paragraph reads, Dr. Kenning also testified, however, that we have newer and better data now than Linehan reflects, that demographic factors are subsumed in actuarial measures such as the SRA-FE, and that Linehan factors are now examined as part of an individual dynamic risk factor assessment. So this court has already considered this argument and basically the exact same testimony and rejected it 5 years ago. One of the questions that was raised to counsel was the flexibility aspect of the courts. The INS decision and mandates provides district courts with flexibility, but also instructions as to what needs to happen. And the district court in this particular case did so. But this court has recognized the flexibility that INS has provided. In another unpublished case, Spicer, the citation to that is?
We have it.
You have it?
Yeah.
And it goes to italics 7. In the second paragraph, moreover, appellant's contention is inconsistent with Minnesota Supreme Court precedent. The Supreme Court recently affirmed the applicability of the Linehan factors and stated that district courts are required to consider those factors despite the potential for factor repetition when those factors are considered in addition to actuarial assessments. A couple of lines later, this court clarified, as a result, the district court is free to consider actuarial and non-actuarial evidence and draw conclusions from that evidence as it sees fit. So this court has long, and this was from a decision from 2015. So for the last 4 years, since the Ince decision, this court has interpreted Ince correctly, and the district courts have the provided guidance they need in order to make good decisions in these cases. The district court in this case listened to the expert testimony, considered all the factors, and identified the important information necessary to support its conclusions as to whether or not Mr. Maul satisfied the criteria for commitment as a sexually dangerous person and/or a sexual psychopathic personality. The district court followed the Ince framework as mandated by the Minnesota Supreme Court, and it establishes very significantly the decisions regarding flexibility, elements, what needed to be done. And the district court did so in a very thorough manner that allows for appropriate appellate review.
Don't we run the risk with all of these different tests that are out there of having overlap and unnecessarily counting certain factors over and over again? I mean, we've got the Blodgett test, we've got the Perkel test, we've got the Irwin test, we've got the Bergmanovsky test, we've got the Linehan test. There are so many tests and so many factors. Aren't most of these already covered in some of the tools that the experts actually use to analyze?
Parts are. However, there is no tool out there that I'm aware of that encompasses all of the factors that the appellate courts deem as appropriate or some things that should be considered. The unfortunate reality with actuarial tools is they don't cover everything that could be potentially important. And that's why this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court have recognized that you cannot place high risk or highly likely based on a result from an actuarial tool. Actuarial tools are developed with those specific criteria in mind on a certain population. So it is incumbent on people to understand that not every tool is going to be applicable to every situation. There needs to be this flexibility. There needs to be this ability for the district courts to listen to the expert testimony to determine, does this test accurately assess risk?
But how do we, on appeal, evaluate it when it's with so many different tests out there, so many different tools, and so many case law tests, or case law factors, I should say, that are to be applied, and there's apparent overlap, not only with the case law, but also with the tools themselves in terms of the factors, whether or not they have actually been applied appropriately. It seems that there's so much room for subjectivity and for a district court to focus on one or more particular factors to the detriment of others to make this determination that has to be made by clear and convincing evidence. So it's a high standard.
It is a high standard, and I just want to clarify a couple things. This court and the Minnesota Supreme Court has dictated that there is not the job of the appellate courts to reevaluate the evidence. The standard is to
whether and I'm not saying we're trying to reevaluate. We're trying to determine whether or not the district court did make a proper evaluation of all the different factors to show that the clear and convincing evidence standard has, in fact, been met.
And so that depends on the findings that the court makes. Did the court identify the important factors, whether or not they were included with a static 99 or if it was a case law factor? Is it supported by the record? Is it supported by the evidence? Is it supported by the testimony? Did the court make appropriate credibility functions or identifications in the findings for appellate review? And that is the whole thing about the review process, are the findings there? And in this particular case, the court did make the appropriate findings in identifying the specific evidence to this particular case and as applied to Mr. Maul's. Is there a concern about this overlapping factors? Potentially. S. But it is up to the district court to make that determination as to what factors are appropriate. The Ince decision does give the appropriate guidance for the district courts and for this court to determine whether or not a person actually meets the criteria for commitment. And in this particular case, the district court did do that. It identified the specific facts, identified the specific case law factors. It was wary of potential factor repetition, but the district court did what it was supposed to do in determining whether or not the actuarial tools appropriately measured risk. And this needs to be clarified. Risk in regards to an actuarial tool is not the same as whether or not highly likely as for an element for the SDP statute or utter lack of power to control. Those are two distinctions. And that needs to be made clear here. So just because we use the phrase risk in relation to a tool, whether or not it's well above average risk or below average risk, that is in relation to the demographics or the pool of offenders that that tool dealt with. So when we're talking about high risk as an element, that is the distinction. That is a significant distinction that needs to be recognized, because just because a person has a certain percentage or risk category on an actuarial tool, that doesn't equate to a legal standard of either highly likely or utter lack.
So for there to be, if following that argument, so if there's to be effective appellate review where a district court is making a finding that isn't supported by the actuarial tools, does the district court need to address that so that it can be effectively addressed on appeal, or how would we do that?
Absolutely, that is the purpose. The Minnesota Supreme Court in Ince and this court in Spicer identified the fact that district courts need to identify whether or not they relied upon something if there's conflicting evidence. And in this particular case, the district court identified the fact that the tools, the actuarial tools in this case, were not indicative or should not be relied upon in assessing risk in regards to Mr. Malls because of the limitations that it contained. So the district court in this case did exactly what the Supreme Court required, which is identify the important information and identify distinctions or identified why it didn't go one way or the other. And that is what's important here, is the district courts are given a broad range of latitude by the Minnesota Supreme Court to make these decisions, and as long as they're making these decisions that's supported by the evidence, that makes things easier for everyone.
You mentioned, counsel, that district courts are free to look at actuarial and non-actuarial tools. But it seems like the district court here only really looked at the actuarial tools and didn't look at any of the non-actuarial tools that could have shed more light on. And appellant in particular points out the SRAFV tool as one in particular that provides insight. Isn't that error that the district court didn't consider any of the non-actuarial tools?
No.
Why not?
No, because the case law factors adequately address those, and the SRA-FV is used in conjunction with the static 99R. So it's supposed to or designed to enhance the static 99R actual results, meaning whether or not the person is in a high-risk category or low-risk, which affects the percentages. So just in my estimation regarding the findings, the district court lumped all the tools together under the actuarials because of the fact that the static 99R and the SRA-FV are included together.
Okay, where in the record can you point to the fact that the district court did consider those two tools together? Because the district court certainly made it very clear he was considering the static 99R.
I can't specifically identify anything in the findings.
Okay.
The only thing I can reference you to is the transcript where there was a lot of testimony and, of course, the reports from the doctors where they assessed that. So the court had all of that information, and the court decided that this was the important information. But on the flip side, it needs to be remembered that you can't parse out one item from either an actuarial or non-actuarial tool because that doesn't accurately reflect the results of that particular tool. And that's, again, one of the drawbacks for either actuarial or non-actuarial tools, is because if there's certain items that may fit or not fit, the percentages that are associated with the results or the categorization as that's associated with the result are skewed because the rest of it doesn't apply to a particular offender. And again, the district court in this case listened to all that and made the distinctions that it needed to make in order for appropriate appellate review and to support its decision that Mr. Malls met the criteria for command.
But the district court did not explicitly reference the SRAFB tool or the SAVPROV tool and say, I'm not considering that because of XYZ. That's not there.
In my memory of reviewing the findings, I did not see that. So I don't believe it's in there. The only thing, again, that I can guess is that the district court lumped all of that together. The district court, I believe, did make a reference to the HARE PCLR, which is a risk assessment, but in specifically with the SRA-SV or the SAFPROV, I don't believe that's mentioned in there. But I don't believe that's any error because, again, the SRA-FV is used in conjunction with the static 99R. In closing, Your Honors, the trial court did not clearly err in finding that Malls met the criteria for commitment as an SDP or SPP. The trial court followed the INS framework in its findings. It identified the important facts, assessed the appropriate case law factors, and conducted its own analysis. The findings are also sufficiently particularized for appellate review. If you don't have any more questions, I will sit down. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish.
Just a couple quick points. If the district court truly did lump all of these tools together, I don't think that's clear in the findings at all. And I think that in addition would be a different type of clear error. These things are very separate tools, and because they look at different things and because of the importance of each of the separate things, static, dynamic, protective factors, to lump everything together makes no sense and I think would be against the vast weight of the evidence and the testimony that was undisputed by the examiners.
Counsel, I want to ask you, it seems like there are really only two items that you're challenging is in the SDP and SPP factors, the third factor in each one, in particular, like, for instance, the SDP third factor, but that goes to the Linehan factors that we look at. And the Supreme Court has made very, very clear and reiterated, we look at those Linehan factors, and I don't want to belabor that point because I think we've already covered that, but for the SPP, it's the utter lack of control. Why does the record not support the district court's finding that he did exhibit an utter lack of control when he testified about how he knew what he knew he was doing was wrong, but he still did it anyway? He repeatedly attacked and sexually molested the victim in this case throughout his treatment, which he never finished, by the way. He never completed any treatment. I know that goes to the Linehan factors, but for SBP, he never completed. There's nothing in the record to show that he's actually addressed any of the issues that he has. So where in the record did the district court err in its findings of showing that he exhibits an utter lack of control for his sexual impulses?
So a couple points. Mr. Malls did complete the primary component of sex offender treatment. He did not complete a program through the aftercare program. So he was in aftercare for quite some time, but you are correct. He did not complete the aftercare program, if that's what you're, you know,
right. The definition.
I'm looking
at
he never
completed the entire
fair
treatment.
Fair enough. However, at the same time, he did not sexually reoffend. And there was testimony from both Dr. Kenning, Dr. Linderman, and Dr. Marshall that despite his shortcomings, he still did not go out and commit a new sex offense.
Well, but he did commit at least two. One against the person who, the minor who eventually became his wife, and then his daughter. Just because it wasn't charged doesn't mean it can't be considered.
I'm not arguing that it can't be considered. I think that we can argue that that individual is not a victim. The district court did find that she was a victim. And then certainly the minor child was clearly a victim. What we know from risk prediction and research is that what makes you risky is that you are reoffend after sanctions.
Right, but he did have contact with a minor female after that he, similar to with his daughter when he was grooming, that he there's acknowledgement that he was trying to groom that child. And then when he was discovered, obviously, they revoked him. But it looked like he was starting that pattern again with yet another potential victim.
That point, I think, was disputed within the testimony. Dr. Kenning did not find that Mr. Malls was in his cycle when in the community. I don't think that it's undisputed that he was grooming a victim. He did have contact and got violated for having that contact. His version, of course, was different than what the reports indicated. In any event,
right,
he
and,
did
and
not,
we look at it in the light most favorable. To
certainly,
the,
certainly. I recognize that. But in any event, he did not reoffend. And again, those things, if you have supervision violations, to the extent that they're relevant to risk, are accounted for within the tools. So had that risen to a level that it truly impacted risk, it would have been included within those tools, and his risk would have been higher than what it was according to the tools, which is based on best practices and research.
Well, it certainly makes sense if somebody actually does reoffend, that would impact the score a lot higher. But the fact that somebody was stopped from reoffending when they were taking steps to do what they had done in the past, it seems like the district court definitely looked at that and said, you know, that's a factor that I'm going to consider here. But going back to the utter lack of control, I think
from my perspective, the utter lack of control and dangerous to others are combined. And that's really where you're looking at for the risk assessment. And while he may have exhibited utter lack of control during the time he was offending, after he was sanctioned, which we know is that important cutoff point from a risk perspective, he did not reoffend. And that is what the research says matters. And, you know,
but
I'm
looking at the case law factors of an utter lack of control. A dangerous to other persons, that's a different factor. But my understanding is you're only challenging the utter lack of control of his sexual impulses.
Challenging both the utter lack and the dangerous piece as they combine. The case law argument that I'm making about why the case law factors are not helpful anymore certainly applies to the utter lack of control factors.
Right, but that goes to your first argument rather than looking at what we have here and what we have to apply here.
Correct, yes. But the challenge for the clear error is more so on the dangerousness piece for the SPP factors.
Okay, thank you.
And just in closing, you know, I think when you look at the behavior, to me this is one of those ick factor things, and the case law factors allow trial courts to rely on the ick factor of the horribleness, you know, that is inevitably sex offending. And I think that the case law factors just allow the platform for that ick factor to be elevated more than the research dictates. So thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. And thanks to you both for your detailed briefing in the matter and your arguments here today. They were both helpful to the court. We'll take the matter under advisement at this time, and we'll issue a decision on the matter within 90 days.